Welcome to another episode of They Came From the North, your weekly Canadian podcast about directors and movie and anything else that strikes our fancy from a particularly Canadian point of view. As usual with me, we have my neighbor to the west, Mr. Andrew Forbes.
You had to think about that for a second, didn't you?
Yeah, I was like, which was west, which was east?
You moved too much.
Hint, the next ones are east.
Find a province and stay in it, Forbes.
You briefly heard from my neighbors to the east, John Mercer.
Hello.
And Steve Power.
How's it going?
And before we hit tonight's...
you going to introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Gabriel Gerard.
He is.
But he needs no introduction.
Yeah,
I'll vouch for him.
You should all know that by now, because I'm the best. Before we get into tonight's episode about John Carpenter, I think it's fitting that we should take a moment to remember Tony Scott, who apparently died of suicide yesterday. We did an episode on Tony, and he was one of our favorite directors. So I think it's important that we mention him and give him some respect today.
You're here.
He's always been one of my favorites, and I believe it was Simon Pegg who fired up on his Twitter today and basically said, you know, all of these people who are now speaking so highly of Tony Scott, it's a shame he couldn't hear it while he was alive. And I always kind of felt that about Tony. I always felt, I mean, you know, we on episode 4, which I went back and I re-listened to last night, we were pretty kind to Tony Scott. I believe it was Andrew even who said, you know, he was probably the most influential action filmmaker of the 1980s. I mean, he pretty much created 90s action. And, I mean, we were kind. We heaped the praise on Mr. Scott, even if we didn't like all of his movies. And it's deservingly so. The guy was an innovator. The guy was a visual genius. And he really did make the blueprint for what would become, you know, mainstream, the Bruckheimer-Simpson formula for action and disaster filmmaking, you know, like Pearl Harbor, Gone in 60 Seconds, The Rock, Con Air, Bad Boys.
Not only that, man,
but he did it better.
And that's the thing.
And once he perfected that formula, the man took strides to evolve himself as a filmmaker.
He was always working. He was always, you know, and he never... He was never a follower. He was a man who, you know, he created a lot of memorable flicks. He created a lot of memorable characters, and he told a lot of memorable stories. And I think, you know, I think it's a little bit sad that he's gone, especially in the fashion that he went, you know.
Now he's up there playing with the boys.
Yeah, Tony Scott was one of that was when I first got to the age where I started recognizing director names on the backs of cases. The old VHS clamshells used to give to the video store. His was one of the names I really picked up on because it was just, you know, say what you will about stuff like Beverly Hills Cop and Top Gun. If you're going to tell me you hated that as a kid, I'm going to tell you you're a fucking liar.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that was just – his was just a name I really picked up on. I stuck with him and, you know, this is just me saying it as a selfish movie fan who – you know, as much as his last movie, Unstoppable, I would consider that one of the higher in his filmmaking pantheon. You know, it's kind of sad to think that we'll never get, you'll never see another of his collaborations with Denzel Washington. You'll never see Tony Scott return to the action genre that, you know, that when you look, say what you will about the action stars, the 80s and that, the mold has got Tony Scott's name written in it.
And as we said, you could still see his style changing and evolving, even as in his later flicks. And it boggles the mind to think what he still could have done and the directions he could have gone if he'd still be alive.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Emma's War was actually shooting it or not. I know they had begun casting, and I know like the plot synopsis and stuff was out there for it, and it really sounded like a great film. It sounded like, you know, a real kind of political thriller in the same mold as, say, Spy Game or even Ridley's, like, Body of Lies. And I was really looking forward to see what
and
was
that's
gonna...
That's the stuff Tony Scott did best, right?
Yeah, mm. Yeah.
So our thoughts go to his younger brother, Ridley, and to
older
the
brother.
Rest.
Brother, man. He's actually his older brother. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
What Tony was the youngest of the three.
Okay, I thought he started on the scene before Ridley.
No, Ridley came first.
No. All right. To his older brother and to the rest of their family.
Clinky.
So tonight we'll be discussing another very influential director, Mr. John Carpenter, one of the few people who actually deserves the title Master of Horror. Carpenter was born in Carthage, New York, in 1948. His father was a music professor, and he was a movie fan from a young age, especially the films of Howard Hawks and John Ford. He studied cinema at the University of Southern California, and he dropped it to make his first feature film, which was Dark Star.
Sorry.
A $60,000 2001 parody co-written by Dan O'Bannon of Return of the Living Dead and Alien fame that really put both of them on the Hollywood map on what they could do on a shoestring budget. The next film after that would be Assault on Precinct 13, very much influenced by Howard Hawks and particularly Rio Bravo, shot for about $1,000. It's an action movie that still holds up, I think. And then the big one, Halloween. The first big slasher picture. Everybody knows about Halloween by now. It was shot for $320,000. It made $65 million on its first run. He then followed Halloween with The Fog, which had some added scenes that the studio requested had to be added because they thought it wasn't horrific enough. So that was the first clash between John Carpenter and the studio. And then he made Escape from New York, another dystopian sci-fi action picture starring Kurt Russell, would go on to star in the following of Carpenter's film, the 1982 The Thing, another Howard Hawks-inspired picture and a classic of 80s horror, especially practical effects. He then did the Stephen King haunted car adaptation Christine, followed up by the E.T. for Adults picture Starman. And that might have been his last really big hit. He followed it with the Kung Fu Gonzo action movie parody Big Trouble in Little China, which didn't perform well at all, but would later become a cult picture. He then made the Prince of Darkness, another horror picture, which he followed with the low-budget action social commentary film They Live, starring Roddy Piper. Then he made a big-budget, what is probably his last big-budget film, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, starring Chevy Chase, which was a big flop, and then put him back into the indies again. He followed it up with In the Mouth of Madness, a Stephen King Lovecraft-inspired horror film starring Sam Neill, followed by The Village of the Damned remake, the follow-up to Escape from New York, Escape from L.A., John Carpenter's Vampires, Ghosts of Mars in 2001, and then on the big I hatest from Ghosts of Mars until 2010 when he did The Ward. So, with that said, let's get into things, and with your good, let's start with John. What is your good for Carpenter?
Oh, the choice is obvious. Okay, when you're talking, you know, about the Master of Terror, I've got to go with what is, in my opinion, pound for pound, the greatest horror movie ever filmed, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Woo!
The Thing is the perfect marriage between 80s gore-tastic splatter effects, all crafted lovingly by a Rob Bottin, whose work on the film was so fevered, I believe he put himself in hospital.
He very nearly killed
himself.
They had
to drag him
off
set and put him in the hospital, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And just underlying tension and this fantastic sense of paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's wonderfully shot. I love Carpenter's one of these guys, you know, never ever centers his frame. Mm-hmm. Right? There's never ever like a point of reference in the middle of a shot. Characters are always kind of off to one side, and you know, kind of just breathe in the scenery and their surroundings.
Oh, if there was ever an argument for full screen versus widescreen, it was John Carpenter.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's one of those directors who uses his framing so well, and especially the CinemaScope.
And despite, you know, The Thing is a movie that, you know, feels claustrophobic, yet his shots are just so wide open and magnificent.
I never bought into the theory that the wider the frame, the more epic in scope it appears. I mean, it's all about how you use it, and John Carpenter's a guy who always knows exactly how to use the frame.
And
you know, I've seen westerns in 4:3 that feel expansive, right?
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, you need a director who really has that eye.
And Carpenter undoubtedly has it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The Thing is just fantastic, fantastic movie. You know, Kurt Russell plays a great lead in helicopter pilot R.J. McCready. If he hadn't already shattered memories of the computer who wore tennis shoes with Snake Plissken, his absolutely kingly beard and gigantic Arctic cowboy hat. Buried those memories in the cold, unforgiving ice of Outpost 31.
Mm.
Just a great movie, great cast. I think the effects still hold up to this day.
I'm there. The effects hold up for me, except for one single shot, and I don't think it was Bottin that did it. I think it might have been Stan Winston.
Stan Winston did the dog.
Exactly. The scene where the dog gets ripped open and stuff. That looks horrible.
Really?
I think the big problem they threw too much light on it.
Yeah, it's like the stop motion is just too plainly obvious, and for me it just looks like really cheesy claymation.
It screams green screen.
Yeah.
Really? Because I actually never knew that any of those were involved.
And no, man, they really engineered a mutagenic alien virus.
Well, that's what I thought.
And they cut off Wilford Brimley's sugar intake. And insane.
My wife did it for 20 years.
And it's each time people bitch about remakes, I always make a point to remind them of The Thing. I'm like, this is one remake that trumps the original. And the original is a pretty good film.
I think we discussed it on the Hawks episode, actually.
Yeah, it's a situation where you know The Thing is a good remake because people don't remember the original.
Yeah.
People don't remember that it is a remake. You know, it's like that new Battlestar Galactica syndrome. People seem to forget that there was a series in the 1970s.
That was cheese.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But, I mean, when you're wearing your Star Wars pajamas and curled up with your Forest Moon of Endor blanket, I mean, Battlestar from the 70s was probably the shit.
And if we talk about The Thing, I mean, we have to mention the ending. Which is chilling.
Yeah.
One of the best endings I've ever seen in a horror.
That wasn't an Arctic pun, was it? It better not be. Chilling. I'll come over there.
And I mean, what really like everything, and it just works perfectly. You got that spur score that completely matches the just blasted wasteland of Antarctica.
Yep.
I've always wondered how much direction Carpenter gave Morricone on that score, because it really feels like a Carpenter score.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just love how it emulates a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. Right? It's great movie, fantastically acted, wonderfully shot, beautifully scored. The effects are awesome. Creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
Plus, it's got Superstition by Stevie Wonder.
It does.
Tense, man. I will always remember myself and Steve one night sat down and watched it with a compatriot of ours who had never seen it. I think we've done this twice, actually.
We've done it at least three times, actually. At least
every
three
single
times.
Time you get to the blood test scene. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. We end up having to break out a spatula and peel someone off the goddamn scene.
It was either Merrick Johnson, Brian Wiscombe, or Tony Collins. All three of them at some point or another like leapt off the couch.
And shrieked.
And even Sarah. First time I showed it to Sarah, same thing.
Well, I hope you have washable couch cushions.
I was always a horror movie fan. I can remember it. You know, issues of Rue Morgue and Fangoria always talking about that wonderful shot in The Omen where the guy gets decapitated by the pane of glass and they had it timed so people in theater who'd be covering their eyes would just be pulling their hands off as the head rolled across frame. Mm-hmm. Well, Carpenter calls you with the blood test scene.
Yeah.
Right? He's all in. And
what's even more amazing about it is you know what's coming. Mm-hmm. You know what's going to happen. You know there's a jump scare coming, but it still gets you.
It's like the stupid hand at the end of Carrie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know what's happening, but you just it still gets you.
And that was something. I mean, I know we're going to talk into because Carpenter, despite being called the master of terror, has offered so much more than simply horror movies.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It just so happens that, in my opinion, my favorite Carpenter movie is a horror movie. Mm-hmm. But he. Yeah, even when it comes to the jump scare, he's so much better at it than
anyone.
Anyone else in there, you know, Chris Craven, all these other guys, they should all bow before John Carpenter.
And he's still got it. I mean, think of what you want of the Ward, but it still had some good jump scares
that was,
in there.
The Ward was a creepy movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Ward, you will notice when we go through mine, the Ward does not appear as my good, my bad, or my ugly, but that's not in detriment to that film. I
have mixed feelings about The Ward, they're mixed.
The Ward suffers from Star Wars Episode I syndrome. There's no way in hell it could live up to the fact that John Carpenter was making a horror movie again.
And yeah. it kind of feels like Identity Redux.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's
And I mean, didn't, man, didn't like... I know we never got in theaters over here. I think it was a limited release in theaters.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, wasn't the whole ad campaign based entirely around
John Carpenter?
Get ready for the Master of Terror.
Yeah, John Carpenter is making a movie again.
It had been, what, 9 years?
Yeah.
You know, if they really wanted to convince people it was going to be a scary movie, they should have just flashed a picture of Carpenter as he appears now.
As he appears in 1975, there's not much difference. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's funny. He slept with the Pharaoh's wife and suffered the Hun Dai.
Yep.
Oh, damn. The most fiendish of all Egyptian curses.
Oh, no.
That's me. Sorry.
They locked him in. They sealed
Please
him in a coffin.
Courteous and turn cell phones
off. Box of Marlboros.
It's my landline, actually.
Oh.
My thing with the thing.
It wasn't anti-smoking PSA. John Carpenter.
My thoughts on the thing is. I love The Thing. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing movie. It's not my good. We'll get to that when it's my turn. But, you know, just as a treatise on paranoia, you know, just to see how paranoia slowly eats away at these guys, you know, and it's just such a paranoid movie. And, I mean, when I'd seen The Thing, I watched it. I think I was 8 years old the first time I watched it. We're at a birthday party or something.
Ladies and gentlemen, parents of the year.
Yeah, well, I mean... There was no real parental control over what we watched back then. But
I mean, the only movie that comes close to it in terms of paranoia is our Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, and even...
Invasion of the Body Snatchers, man, is nothing compared to The Thing.
Yeah, but It's the only one that comes close.
Yeah, and I
did Drew Struzan paint a poster for Invasion of the Body Snatchers? No.
I see.
Does Invasion of the Body Snatchers have the title effect burn into the screen? No.
I see stuff now. I see movies like, you know, Cabin Fever and other and a lot of these new thrillers that come along, and they really play up on what the Thing brought to the table. Like Cabin Fever, for all intents and purposes, is identical to the Thing. You know, it's just instead of an alien organism, it's a viral infection. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's the same movie. One guy, they find out he's infected, they take him out, they lock him in the shed. You know, like it just blows my mind how much has taken from the Thing. And before that, I mean, the only thing really that even came close to it was Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It was just such a paranoid movie. It was wound so tight. And, of course, Russell. I mean, Kurt Russell's performance. And the rest of the cast, too. But, I mean, Russell was just... He brought it so much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody. I mean, all the guys were great. Richard Dysart, Wilford Brimley. They were all good. You know, everybody was good. No one was...
Brimley was actually only 23 when they shot that.
Diabetes.
Who was... I swear to God, I've seen him in movies... After it, I always had a soft spot for, El Capitan. What's his name?
Donald Moffat?
Yeah.
Gary?
Yeah, Gary.
I'm pretty sure he was in an episode of Columbo.
I know you gentlemen have been through a lot.
Yeah.
The only other thing I'll add, my only other, like, my parting thought on the Thing probably is... Objectively speaking, Carpenter's most accomplished film. You know, like it really is, and it was also the pseudo inspiration for our logo. It came from the North Banner.
We're all making our creepy Thing faces.
Creepy Thing. I just want to say up front, The Thing is my favorite John Carpenter movie. Although I didn't choose it as my good because there's another one there that I think doesn't get as much attention as it should. The Thing, just good, awesome. And it's the kind of movie, I think everyone agrees. It's one of those rare instances where everyone actually has the right opinion at this point.
Andrew, that makes you a murderer.
Oh, no. I mean, I think Carpenter is someone that has done so many good movies that it's important to feature more than just a Thing, you know.
It's
a great movie and I love it, and I wholeheartedly agree that it's probably his best movie.
It's definitely his best, but it's not my favorite.
Oh, we know that, Steve.
Yeah, we'll keep
you. It wouldn't be you if you, you know.
So, we'll keep Steve waiting a little, and we'll go with Andrew. What's your good?
All right, my good, as I was just saying, a movie that I think gets a lot of criticism and kind of dismissed, but I actually think it's a very, very good horror movie, and that is Christine. It is.
Some say she was just born bad.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's Maybelline. But there, first of all, everyone knows there are very few really good Stephen King adaptations.
That's because there's not a lot to work with.
Well,
power.
Let's not get this.
I'm going to throw all my Stephen King books in a pillowcase and beat you with them. I only own them all over 1,000 pages.
The only Stephen King novel worth owning is On Writing, okay?
I'll take my art cover in this of the stand and beat you with
it. Oh, dear God.
Gabriel, you can't lift your hardcover copy of the stand.
Oddly enough, you can only hold it while sitting. Ironic. What was I saying? Oh, Christine. All right. Not very many good Stephen King adaptations. And, you know, there are, I think, even fewer that really capture the atmosphere that he has in his books of, you know, a sort of his particular view of New England.
Terrifying yet familiar.
Yeah. And growing up in Nova Scotia, which is very close to Maine, like his descriptions of sort of the surroundings and the towns feel very much like the the kind of place I grew up in. So
and Newfoundland.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You guys are above the tree line. Come on. But yeah, Christine is, aside from some, you know, notable flaws, is a really effective movie that also sort of showcases Stephen King's love of cars and sort of 50s Americana. It's an 80s movie with 80s characters, but it kind of feels like it's taking place in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the main character, played by Keith Gordon, some might say overplayed by Keith Gordon.
some might.
He's your sort of standard nerdy outcast who ends up sort of falling in love essentially with a car, which basically is evil incarnate, I guess. It's never really explained what Christine is, but I don't think that... I think
the movie's stronger for that fact, actually.
They try to give some kind of stupid, you know, they built the car on an Indian burial ground or something.
No, I don't think even in the novel he explains it.
No. Probably has something to do with the Micmacs. I mean, the thing was, and Carpenter, like, it feels like a studio picture, like a little bit of a, you know, picture for hire, but he directs the hell out of it. Mm. And, you know, when it comes to the stalking sequences of Christine sort of cruising down the road or creeping up on people and smushing them in various ways, he just absolutely nails it. And he also does a really good job, you know, aside from some uneven performances from some young actors, of conveying that sense of being an outsider, you know, being envious of sort of how easy some of your friends have it compared to what you have. And the sense of, you know, being young and sort of discovering your very first intense interest in something.
And I think we need to give it some points for actually making you believe in a haunted car, which is pretty ludicrous.
Yeah. And it has everything to do with the atmosphere that Carpenter sort of evokes around this thing, and selling the fact that the car is responding sort of as a person, responding emotionally.
I mean, the nearest movie, I think, in his filmography to Christine is maybe The Fog and the kind of atmosphere that he's trying to make, you know, that kind of supernatural.
Eeriness.
Yeah.
Very eerie. Yeah. Very, very, you know, like, I hate to throw the word around with reckless abandon, but very Lovecraftian. Very foreboding.
And it's got one of my favorite opening scenes of all time with the George Thorogood.
Yeah.
Band to the bone.
Band to the bone.
Yeah.
I have to say, like, one of my favorites. You know those scenes in movies that you kind of forget about? And then you're watching a movie and it just punches you in the face again. Like, you somehow forget about this amazing scene and then you watch it again and it sort of impacts you the same way every time. Maybe not. Pretend that was
horrible. I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
The show me scene is that for me in this, when Arnie sort of gets what Christine is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He stands in front of her and he says, you know, show me. And Christine basically shows off what she can do. And it is incredibly creepy, not only because you're dealing with a haunted car, but because at that moment you're dealing with a guy who's sort of embracing this very dangerous entity.
Potentially evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he kind of takes on the car's wickedness,
persona.
Yeah, wickedness, yeah. We'll say, you know.
Well, he couldn't go really, you know, it was still the early 80s when it was filmed. I think it's set in the late 70s, so he couldn't quite go emo, but he does for a little while in the movie kind of go evil rocker.
Yeah.
Like evil greaser.
Yeah.
One of the things,
and
that,
you know, one thing I really like about it is
the part of
you guys are talking about, you know, setting up the atmosphere and everything. Even at the end of the movie when Christine goes full on Terminator, it doesn't take you out of it at all.
Yeah.
right?
I mean, I think I may have been 10 or 11 when I first saw it, and it was one of those things, you know, where we used to just go and raid the horror collection at the local video store, and I think
it had a great cover too, man.
It did. It had an awesome cover, and I mean, it was one of those movies that we went back to a few times. It was one of those ones that we'd go and we'd pick out, and our local video store had this 99-cent rack that was just all old horror movies, you know, like everything that wasn't a new release kind of thing. And myself and a buddy of mine would always go down and we'd always pick out three or four, and like, you know, we'd be there and we'd have two or three in our hands and we're like, oh, let's just get Christine. You know, it was that kind of movie for us. And and one of the things, like, from way back from, like, I and it was the first time I ever watched it. I can still remember playing this day. The one thing that really stood out to me was how cool the regeneration scenes looked when the car used to, like, fix the dents.
Mm-hmm. And for some reason, you know, at the end of it, when you see the piece of fender start to
For some reason, just you know, when you're 10 years old or whatever, and you see this stuff, for some reason that always stood out in my mind, and it was always something like whenever I sit down and I watch the movie again, it was always kind of like, oh haha, yeah, you know, like that kind of feeling. Like I guess kind of like what you were saying, Andrew.
Sorry?
Kind of like what you were saying about the show me scene. You know, it was something like whenever I see that for some reason, I always get that little internal smile, you know? Because it was such a well-done effect for the time, you know?
And it's such a, I mean, it's a simple effect, too.
Yeah,
it's
really simple. They just filmed something in reverse.
They could have done it in the silent days, you know?
Yeah.
Something about the way they showed it, even the fact that I know how they do it, it's still totally... sells it to me.
It was a plastic body or something, wasn't it? Isn't that how they did it? They used it like
I think probably, yeah.
And they just filmed, they dented it using a vacuum or something and filmed it in reverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing that keeps me from going totally with it is definitely Keith Gordon, especially when he goes psycho near the end.
With me, it's that midpoint where he's like, shut up, baby, I'm the coolest. You know, like, just dismissive of everyone. And it's like, in a sense, it's awful. But at the same time, if I really think about it, high school students, especially nerdy high school students who suddenly get a bit of attitude, are totally like that.
Yeah, for
oh my
sure.
God, yeah, yeah.
Like.
And then it's up to his popular jock friend to put him back in his place.
I have a certain friend.
Really, the moral of this movie is, you know, if you're a loser, don't try.
I have a not really a friend. I'll say an acquaintance. He used to be a friend years and years and years ago who went to school with us, and he did become the lead singer of a rather popular a folk music band. I won't mention any names. But for a while, he had a big reputation, like, among all of us who went to school with him as being a real douche. And, you know, when he was in high school, he just hung out in the music room. He was a geek. You know, he was one of the music room geeks. But, of course, he hit big, and, I mean, not just in Canada, but they got to
put... He was in Glee Club?
No. Well, yeah, he could have been. But, you know, that's a prime example. You know, for a while, he was pretty cocky and stuff. But as he got older, he mellowed out. And, I mean, you know, now you can talk to the guy best kind again kind of thing, right? But...
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I know who you're talking about.
You know exactly who I'm talking about.
I have a suspicion.
But I'm not mentioning names.
Yeah. Also, on one last thing about Christine, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yes.
Super cool.
Yeah, always. Well, when isn't...
Just as the cop lurking around.
Yeah. When is he not cool?
Don't get smart with me, son.
No. You didn't smoke enough cigarettes to say that in Harry Dean Stanton's voice.
Don't get smart with me, son.
This was when he was still relatively, you know.
He always looked ancient, man. Come on.
Oh, I know.
This is when Harry Dean Stanton looked 47 as opposed to 100.
Yeah. Yeah. He and John Carpenter must have went to the same parties.
And Robert Blossom looks about 150 in this. And I'm pretty sure he was only, like, 45 or something.
All right, so, Steve, your turn.
Okay. I love Carpenter. I love a lot of Carpenter's movies, you know, and I was tempted to go with something obscure. I was tempted to, you know, pick something just because I knew we wouldn't talk about it. You know, I was tempted to go with something like Assault on Precinct 13, which I love. Escape from New York, which is not obscure, but, you know, which I didn't think any of us was going to pick. The Thing, of course, but in the end, I had to go with my heart. I had to go with my gut, and my absolute favorite by far film by John Carpenter is Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes!
In the pantheon of 80s action movies, I think there are maybe three or four movies out there that are as perfect as this movie. For me, you know, I think from the opening frame, from that little tease with the Egg Shen sitting in the lawyer's office, you know, you leave Jack Burton alone, you know, all, and you see that was nothing. But that's
we should probably apologize to our listeners, you know, for the
Charlie Chan accent.
The Charlie Chan accent.
Hey, to be fair, you're doing a specific impression of an actual line in a movie.
But it like just every aspect of that film worked for me. You know, you get Kurt Russell on the CB and he's just so full of bravado, he's so cocky. And then when the film really kicks in and the tables are turned and you got little Wang Chi who's the, you know, becomes the hero protagonist, and Russell just ends up being relegated to sidekick, still dialogue of hero protagonist. Like, and it's not just a little, like, it's not a blatantly obvious turning of the tables. It's more of a, like, Carpenter is almost kind of more winking about it, you know, like, you know, when you're...
Well, this movie is one giant...
Yeah, when you're 10 or 11 years old, you think Jack Burton is the coolest guy in the world, and then you watch it again in your 20s, and you're like, man, he is such a geek.
First time plugging a guy?
Of course not. And
it's one of those movies, like, the first time I catched it was, like, by luck on TV, and I just got in when the Gods of Thunder were descending for the first time.
Yeah.
Like, when he just got into Chinatown, and I was like, what the fuck is this? Why have I never heard about this? This is awesome.
And guys, I freak in that scene when you get the kind of, like, low-angled camera shot looking up at... I think it's Rain,
yeah.
And Three Storm, and he's doing the crazy face.
But it's just every single minute of that movie has something quotable or some amazingly well-mounted action sequence like that alley.
Goddamn right, you're going to help me find it, and my money and time is money to a guy like me, and your phone is dead by the way.
Or some crazy gonzo stuff like the eye of Lo Pan, that weird bubbly thing that I don't know where they got the idea.
Oh, no. Come on. What is that? Oh, don't tell me.
And just, you know,
all right.
Every little turn of phrase.
Whoa. Steve Hawk.
What?
Go.
Okay. No, like every little turn of phrase in the movie, every little like character interaction, everything is timed so perfectly, so exquisitely, you know, like just framed within what's going on in the movie. Like, you know, it's not like, you know, you're sitting down watching a Kevin Smith movie and they take a break for one-liners, you know, or even like, say, The Expendables 2, where they throw an obvious one-liner at the screen. Like, everything just feels so natural in it. To me, it's very near a perfect action film, and I'll leave it at that. The action in the movie is just so amazingly well mounted. That fight is beautiful.
And the amazing thing is that it still holds up, and it still can be entertaining. Like, I showed it to my younger brothers who are like 17 and 15, and they thought it was a riot.
Oh, it's an amazing movie.
And I'm like, these guys don't know anything about Hong Kong cinema or whatever, you know, and they still enjoyed it.
These guys are idiots, and they loved it. I just wanted to say before, you know, when I was about to interrupt you like four times back then, you know, I absolutely love Big Trouble in Little China, but I don't think it's quite as flawless as you say it is.
Okay, why do you got to bring that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, never mind. I retract. No, but one thing I want to say is,
Andrew,
especially
with
regard to the action, I totally disagree with you about the action. John Carpenter, he can do many things. He can't film action.
I see. Now, I thought Big Trouble had amazing action sequences. I really did. I mean, it's not kinetic like Lethal Weapon or something like that, you know, but I thought he did a great job on the action.
I mean, there are a few moments in the alley sequence that are well edited, but... I mean, especially that ending section with the, like, jumping on trampolines to fly through the air. That stuff is brutal.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was amazing.
Oh. It's supposed to look like a comic book.
Especially when you know the kind of low-budget Chinese movies he was ripping off.
I mean, he was totally – he had his crosshairs set firmly on Golden Harvest, you know?
Yeah, which does it much better with similarly low budgets. I'm not saying – you know, there are ways to make action look like a comic book without having it obvious that you're just having the camera at a super low angle, having guys jump on trampolines and doing flips. And then when they sort of flip together, and then the motion in the next shot is completely different. And then it's like the guy is against a green screen with background flying through.
Now it's official. Next time I'll host the podcast, I'll just introduce you as Oscar the Grouch.
I can't even talk about.
More like Oscar the Douche.
Andrew's gonna just.
We could just sit around going, every movie is great. But that would be less interesting, I think.
Well, okay, next time, just don't pick on Big Trouble in Little China.
I realize I'm basically curb stomping your daughter.
You're slaughtering one of my sacred cows right now.
You can diss Michael Douglas all you want, but don't touch Big Trouble.
It's an amazing comedy, but it's not a great action movie.
I respectfully disagree. I do. I think it's a fantastic.
Bitch must pay.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic action movie. I love the way the action's mounted in it. I think it's just so high energy.
All right, moving on. for my good, I'm not sure it's actually my favorite, but I'd be remiss if we didn't discuss Halloween a little.
Halloween. Say Halloween.
Hey!
There's your Canadian content.
That movie is lightning in a bottle.
Sorry, Gabe, just one second, because right now I'm just picturing Mitch going, what the hell was that? looking up from a plate of peach cobbler.
Boy, would you rewind that?
Yes, because he actually probably tapes off the show on reel to reel. Because he's old, see.
All right,
you guys are jerks.
I love you, Mitch.
Radio powered by mint juleps.
On to Halloween. So yeah, it's as I was saying, it's lightning in a bottle. It came out of nowhere and made a big hit, and it's not for nothing. It's a movie that extraordinarily creepy and well thought out, and I mean everything in it just works perfectly. And the main, I mean Michael Myers is an extraordinary creation in that. They don't try to explain it. It's just there murdering people in very brutal ways. I mean, that first opening shot, the continuing opening shot going up the stairs and everything, that just pulls you right in and then tells you that you have something special in store. I know you guys, the two other guys don't have any love lust for Argento. But I feel it's very much Argento influence, especially something like Deep Red, with the creepy little music, and I mean it could be
floating camera,
dreamy kind of sense.
That being said, though, man, I've never given a copy of Halloween the Garvin stomp.
No. And
I want to jump in here, and you know I may as well. Hey, actually, sorry, I should check first. Am I allowed to say anything sort of negative?
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
No, for sure? No. Oh, wait. Are we talking about Halloween now?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Fire away.
Halloween is, you know, obviously hugely influential. And, but I have never been scared by it. And I kind of feel that this was before John Carpenter really knew how to direct people as people. And everyone in the movie feels like, to me, like they're reading lines, like they're just, none of it feels at all natural. Not that every performance has to be naturalistic, but I really don't buy a lot of the actors. And without that, it kind of just feels like a technical exercise to me.
I think it's a fair criticism.
Also, I don't know. Honestly, if you love Halloween and you can't appreciate Argento, then you're full of shit. I agree with Gabe. I'm sorry. But if you think Halloween's the greatest thing ever and you don't like Argento, then, or at least you can't understand that Argento does some things very well, you're full of shit. Because, you know, it's the same, it's exactly the same amazing stylistic, atmospheric, technical proficiency with awful performances.
Now, see, my whole thing with Halloween versus, like, say, Suspiria is, to me, it's Argento without the pretension. Like, mm-hmm. For me, Argento is just, he's so self-indulgent, and he's so, at least in the early films that I saw, and I mean, like I said, I'm not well-versed, I'm no Argento scholar, I've seen 4 movies, you know? But the guy, like, for him, it's all about the style. And particularly with Suspiria, his reach definitely exceeded his grasp as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you with Suspiria, but some of his movies, I think he's just out to, you know, really make a scary movie, and that's
but now,
Carpenter's
I think and... I think Carpenter, you know, I think Carpenter took what he wanted from Argento, but I think there's enough of John Carpenter in there to differentiate him significantly. I think Halloween definitely feels more like
No, I agree. And I'm not saying it's an Argento ripoff by any means, because it's not.
And now, again, this is coming from someone who enjoys Halloween but doesn't necessarily love it. I do find Halloween to be a pretty effective exercise in tension. And it amazed me, actually, when I went back. Like, my whole thing with horror movies, I mean, I was a fan when I was, you know, in just closing out single digits and getting into my young teenage years. I was a fan of horror movies. I grew out of them. I never went back to them until, you know, I started looking at my colossal DVD, like 700 or 800 DVDs, and realized, you know what? I own very, very little in the way of horror movies. Like, and I started to kind of to go back and try to rediscover some horror stuff. And Halloween was one of the first, and I picked up a box set of the Friday the 13th films, and it blew my mind after watching Halloween just how much the first 2 Friday films ripped it off.
And how much better Halloween is.
Halloween is better, but you know what? They were the best 2 of the Friday films, too.
But you know what? You know? I would take Black Christmas over Halloween any day of the week.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
any day.
You're just saying that because you like the Canadians. That's your thing, see?
I would accept that, except that it was an American who directed it.
Black Christmas was an American?
I thought Bob Clark was Canadian.
Yeah, Bob Clark's Canadian, isn't he?
Texas.
Hmm?
It was a Canadian production in the sense that it was done all in Canada with Canadian actors, and it was a Canadian script.
Yeah.
But the director was American.
Clark is an American?
Yes.
I did not know
it. Would you like to say it again?
I thought he was from Toronto or something.
No.
He's from New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Mm. There we go.
He lived in Canada, though, didn't he?
He worked in Canada.
He worked in
Canada. From 1973 to 1983, he worked in Canada.
Right.
Because that, you know, there were all these, like, tax shelters. And
I mean, he did Porky's.
Yeah.
The most successful Canadian film until Volca Bad Cup.
I thought...
Fine, successful.
Yeah, I thought we agreed when we decided to get together and do this podcast, we would never, ever speak ill of Porky's.
Porky's was the highest grossing Canadian theatrical release of all time until Fellowship of the Ring. Fellowship of the Ring was the first movie to gross more in box office dollars in Canada than Porky's.
Oh, okay. I was like, I'm sure that wasn't a Canadian movie.
No, just in general. That'll tell you how successful Porky's was.
That'll tell you
how we live in bizarro world.
Oh.
But before we close down the discussion on Halloween, I have to mention one of my favorite shots where Michael Myers, he stabs some guy, like, on the closet, and then he just looks up at him as
That's
if
one
he
of
just,
the best moments of the movie.
As if he just pinned the butterfly or something.
Yeah.
He's just kind of like, huh, imagine that.
He's a creepy, creepy, creepy bastard in that film.
Yeah.
But, although I still really, really love Halloween, I think it's a very, very effective movie. Very, as I said, very creepy. And the tension just keeps rising and rising until it explodes.
But why did he show Michael Myers' face? I don't understand why Carpenter did that.
It, I, Yeah, that's kind of dumb.
I don't think it was ever really meant to be anything more than the one film, you know? Like, I don't think he thought of franchising it, so I guess he kind of figured, you know, that would be a payoff. That would be something that the audience would want to see.
I'm not even thinking in terms of the sequels. I just feel like he's this presence, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, he's a blonde guy from down at the beach. finished surfing.
Again, you know, I think... And it's hard to separate. Like, you think about Halloween, and it's hard to separate it from the franchise that it birthed, you know?
No, because I've never seen any sequel. I refuse to.
Good man.
By the way, though, if anyone tells you that, like, for some reason, the walk in the first one is way creepier than Michael Myers' walk in the sequels, I think they're just seeing things.
Yeah, I agree.
When you have an anonymous guy in coveralls.
Walking like a gorilla.
Shuffling a bit. It doesn't matter who's there.
No, I agree. I agree. It's like all these people.
He was a frequent Carpenter collaborator, the guy who did Myers. I don't remember his name. Nick Castle?
And he went on to write Hook and direct Dennis the Menace. Those are the scariest things he ever worked on.
It's kind of like those people who, you know, bitch and moan about Kane Hodder being the best Jason Voorhees. It's like, get over yourselves, guys. Just get over yourselves.
The only requirement to being Jason Voorhees is that the mask fits and you're 8 feet tall.
But, Halloween is awesome. If you've never seen it, see it right now. Onto our bads, which is not a film that we hate. It's a movie that we might like, but we find has too many flaws to be really good. Or just a movie that we really like a lot, but are ready to admit major flaws. So let's start again with John.
Bastard. I was kind of torn on this one. At first, I was thinking about going with Starman, but, you know, Karen Allen is just the personification of cute, and I've got this volcanic man crush for Jeff Bridges. I can never out and out hate anything that Jeff Bridges is in.
I am Clue. I am from a computer. Sorry.
Don't even get me started on Tron. You thought Black Rain was bad.
Yeah, if you guys start dissing Tron, I might have to leave.
Yeah. But, No, I really couldn't go with Starman. I went back, I watched it. You know, it's very much a product of his times, but I really enjoyed it.
I thought it was a cool. I thought it was like a nice, warm-hearted Carpenter flick.
Yeah,
and it's not my personification. It's not what I felt was, you know, how we describe our bad. Something that we feel had the potential to be a good movie, but just has a few little nitpicks that kind of haul it down. Mm. When I think about that, I think about how the 90s treated John Carpenter. And I got to go with something that had so much potential I was really excited for and then saw it and was just like, oh, well. And that's In the Mouth of Madness.
Mm. That makes me sad.
I really like In the Mouth of Madness.
Actually. I like In the Mouth of Madness, too. I love In the Mouth of Madness, but... You know, it's one of those ones, it doesn't really feel like a Carpenter movie.
Really?
Yeah.
It suffers from something that that Village of the Damned had as well, and a few of his movies.
It's not like, near as bad as Village of the Damned.
No, I'm going to get to Village of the Damned. But it feels, everything about it feels sort of cheap and I don't even know how to quite describe it. It's like...
empty calories.
Yeah.
Empty everything. It's populated enough. It's like the sets are too spare.
It's like all a Himes, it's like a Himes movie.
Yeah.
it's like a TV thing.
Only it's not set on the streets of Chicago and with two people.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, though. It's almost got like a made for TV vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's it doesn't have the richness of his like of his better movies.
But there is an awesome Sam Neill in performance at the center of it all.
I mean, I love it. It is one of my favorite Carpenter movies. I actually really, really dig it. David,
and let's not forget Jürgen Prochnow as yeah. was like one of the creepiest men in the world. Just, I don't really think he only has a couple lines in it.
Yeah,
but like, as soon as you see him on screen, just
a little bit of
please don't call me, please don't eat my firstborn.
Interesting trivia about In the Mouth of Madness.
Go ahead.
The DVD is actually extremely rare now. I sold mine about 6 months ago for over $100.
Wow.
Sure. Wait a minute, we gave that back to you?
Yep.
Oh, I remember Elizabeth had that borrowed from you for like 2 years.
Yeah, she brought it back, and I had a friend of mine message me on Facebook one day and asked, like, say, hey, do you own the movie In the Mouth of Madness? I remember you being a real big John Carpenter fan. I was like, oh, yeah, I own it. And he's like, dude, do you know how much it's worth? And I'm like, no, and I fired up Amazon and then eBay and looked at prices, and I was like, wow, holy crap. He's like, dude, I'll give you like $125 for it right now. I was like, yeah, sure. Here you go. You know?
You do realize that that was just part of a ritual that the old ones needed you to perform so that they could break back into our world.
Well, hey, whatever. I made $125.
And that's one of the weird things, because it both feels like a Stephen King picture and like a Lovecraft.
It's definitely got that Lovecraft eeriness, that whole sense of foreboding and like impending doom.
It's consciously and really not subtly saying, I am doing Stephen King, I am doing H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
I find, you know, John Carpenter does have moments when he can get a bit pretentious. I find In the Mouth of Madness is one of them.
Fair enough.
You know, he's like, oh my goodness, can you believe how insane this is? Could the horror get any scarier?
But there's some really subtle, creepy stuff in there as well. Just that kid riding on the bike.
I do love the, Hayden Christensen, by the way, was the kid on the bike.
He was, yeah.
That's why it's so creepy.
Also,
he was an owl made out of
the lady running the inn, Frances Bay.
Mm. Yeah,
I was gonna say the immortal Frances Bay, but she died last year.
Sadly,
but you know, with like what was it? Her husband's like chained up.
Yeah,
desk. That is one of those moments where it just sort of subtly twists what seems totally benign into something really kind of sinister. And yeah,
Viggo the Carpathian was in this movie.
Yep.
Yeah, man.
Oh yeah,
he was like this angry guy at the bar or something. Wasn't
wow
he?
I gotta look up a copy. I gotta buy this oh right.
It can be gotten.
We're just saying it's got one of the most boring commentaries I've ever heard.
Is it a solo Carpenter commentary?
No. Well, that's boring, but imagine him with his DP and asking him every 5 seconds what kind of light and filter he used.
So what kind of lens did you use here?
Yeah, John Carpenter sometimes acts more like a moderator on his own commentaries.
The Big Trouble in Little China commentary is still one of my favorite commentaries of all time.
Yeah, anyone with Kurt Russell is a hoot.
Yeah.
They don't talk about the movie, though.
I still.
You want to know about junior hockey in Canada?
I still love. What is it? So, John, did this movie ever make money? Well, no. I still haven't seen a royalty check, Kurt. So, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
All right, Steve. What's your bad?
My bad. You guys are not going to like me. It's not a popular choice, I don't think. I can't even say that because this is our bads. This is.
Yeah.
Movies we like, but we consider to be flawed. And I'm going with Escape from New York.
I'm leaving. No.
It's a gritty, dark, bleak, you know, solid story and all of that kind of stuff. But I just think that it's really, really, really dumb.
Hurry up, Snake.
Dumb ass dragging
escape from New York.
And also every character in the movie outside of Plissken wants me makes me want to pound nails into my ears.
Everybody's like, hey, how are you? Hey, you know, and it's just like,
I'm Ernest Borgnine. Look at the size of my giant mouth.
Well, I want to pound the barbells, but that's something else.
Yeah.
I actually totally agree with you about it. I love it but at the same great. Time,
the movie looks
it could have used some trimming.
It looks fantastic, especially for what it was made for. You know, the budget was so low, and the fact that they got a lot of those effects to work, and you know, like Carpenter shows that even on a shoestring budget, he could really turn out something effective. But just
Mad Max, it ain't.
It just didn't.
It's another example of Carpenter not being able to do action.
Yeah.
You know, the atmosphere is great, but he can't pull off the action when he needs it to be exciting.
Now for me, see, and that's the opposite. Like with Big Trouble in Little China, yeah, I found the action exciting. I found it pretty high energy and pretty riveting. But with Escape from New York, the action just feels so rote. Mm-hmm. Like never any heightened sense of drama or excitement. It's always
Let's just look at this thing.
From finish.
He gets into a fight with spiked baseball bats with a guy who looks like King Kong Bundy.
Yeah, and it's just
and it's boring.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? That's one of the few ones in the movie that I kind of like. I wouldn't point to it as an example of like fantastic action filmmaking. It's just kind of like it's gritty and kind of cool and you feel the weight of the hits. So.
And one thing that's good that it's got going for it is that for such a low budget, they've got such a good cast. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lee Van Cleef, Isaac Hayes, Harry Dean Stanton, Borgnine.
Lee Van Cleef is the coolest man alive, except he's dead. But if he were alive,
he'd burn you off the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go, Steve.
I picked up the Blu-ray a little while. Well, now it was more than a little while ago. I got it. I think it was probably not last summer, summer before when it was first released. When it first came out on Blu-ray.
Doesn't that Blu-ray look like greased asshole? Though?
No, it looks awesome. Actually, it looks really good. But it was, you know, it just.
Sorry, can we hear that that description again, John?
Greased asshole.
No, it is a nice Blu-ray. It's a nice natural looking Blu-ray. But I just. I'd forgotten how slow the movie was. It's kind of one of those things where Snake Plissken as a character, you know, has been remembered more fondly than the movie itself has been, you know?
He's got some great lines and he's got a great look.
Oh, right? Russell is amazing. He's absolutely amazing in his movie. But it's one of those movies that people remember Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken more fondly than they remember the movie itself.
Yeah. And I just want to point out Frank Doubleday, though, as the, like, the creepy second in command.
Yeah.
Isaac Hayes. It, like, that is a great performance.
Can I let you guys in on a dark, dark secret?
Sure.
How dark? And is it greased?
It's greased. It's glistening in sweat.
If you're about to say you prefer Escape from L.A. to Escape from New York, I will agree with you.
I prefer Escape from L.A. to Escape from New York.
I also prefer Escape from L.A., but I still chose it as my bad as well.
segue! We got a segue!
But I'm not done with New York yet. it's a fine line for me between the two. I enjoy them both.
As we once said on the in the jury room, Escape from L.A. is the Evil Dead 2. To Escape from New York, Evil Dead 1.
Exactly.
It's both a remake and a sequel, and it's so much crazier and so much more fun. But it's still a flawed movie, I think.
And it has one of my favorite lines of all time. You may have survived Cleveland. You may have escaped from New York. But this is L.A., baby. And this city can fucking kill anybody.
I don't think he calls him baby. I think he calls him pendejo.
Maybe that's what it is. But either way,
or something similar.
That line is just awesome. I roared sitting down in the
theater.
Which one had the immortal snake line, I don't give a shit about your war or your president?
That was the first one, I believe.
Get a new one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's
the second one, I think, because in the first one the line is, you've got to save the president. And he's like, the president of what?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I don't give a shit about your war is in the second one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the entire Arthurian slant is even more pronounced in Escape from LA. I love that ending. And the main reason I chose it as my bad is because I wanted to talk about it. I really, really love that movie, but even then, it's a bit too crazy for its own good, and that cheap CGI wave.
CGI, oh. And
That's the only scene for me, is like if Peter Fonda had been cut out of that movie altogether, it would have been perfect.
Also, can we just...
Even with the hang gliders?
Yes. Even with the hang... I'm cool with the hang gliders.
Oh, dear.
Without the hang gliders, you can't have Carjack.
That's right.
Oh, Pam Grier.
Pam Grier as a transsexual. That's awful.
Pam Grier?
And we have to mention Bruce Campbell as well.
As the plastic... What was it, the Surgeon General of Beverly Hills?
Yeah, and I'm not a huge Campbell fanboy.
Nor
right? He's got his... But he's fucking awesome in Escape from LA.
Yeah.
And I still find...
My God, they're real.
Every now and again, I find myself dropping the Steve Buscemi line in reference to fast food, actually. Whenever I'm eating, like, Wendy's or something, it's grade A artery choker.
One thing I'll give to Escape from L.A., it has 100% more Stacy Keach.
It sure
and Cliff Robertson.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cliff Robertson successfully playing a scumbag.
Big like, surprise.
No, but you gotta, like, okay, on one hand, he's Uncle Ben. But on the other hand, he's the theocratic dictator of the United States.
Okay, because all I know Cliff Robertson from is De Palma's Obsession.
Oh, no.
You have to watch Underworld USA. You have to.
Awesome movie, actually. Really good.
Also, he played a villain on the 60s Batman show.
He did.
Intriguing.
He was Shame.
He sure and was.
Evil cowboy.
And I have to mention the score for Escape from LA, which is pretty fun with the flamenco influence in there.
And the Wild West twang at the end of it.
And,
you know?
And also the villain is much more interesting, I think, than the Duke of New York.
He was. He
was. The chief. Yeah. The guy you think he's the new Che Guevara, basically.
And he's named after tequila. Mervo.
Well, that was kind of, you know, they all had their, you know, their macho nicknames: Snake Plissken,
yeah,
Carjack Malone, Cuervo Jones,
Cabby.
like Escape from New York, to me was, you know, that's an effective kind of gritty stepping stone between the Warriors and Blade Runner. Right? You're moving out of the 70s into the 80s, but Escape from L.A. is the type of thing I would watch a weekly TV show about.
Yeah, yeah.
that world, or read a comic book set in that world.
Can you imagine a video game? That would be awesome.
There was one in the works by the guys who made the Dead to Rights games on Xbox and PS2, but it got canned when Deborah Hill passed away. All of the resurgence of Escape from LA pretty much died.
Did you guys know that Kurt Russell co-wrote the screenplay for LA?
Yes, he did, yeah.
I mean, how awesome is that?
Exactly. It's kind of sad because he was really poised for, like, a comeback. You know, they had a comic book series. They were talking about an animated movie. Like,
well, I don't think, you know, Kurt was really hurting for roles at that point. You know, he was... The guy wasn't exactly the least popular actor of the 90s.
No.
But
I don't know. You know what? When LA came out and the ads started going on TV, I would have been 14. So probably like the ideal audience.
I was 19 and I thought it was the coolest thing ever.
And I know that like me and my friends thought it was incredibly lame looking.
Wow.
Because it looked like it looked like some old guy trying to be the coolest guy around. So I realize I was wrong.
I think I was about 19 when it came out, and my drug-addled mind thought it was the coolest thing ever. But now, mind you, I was also very, very familiar with Escape from New York because that was, of course, a movie I grew up with, right? So,
I think it.
Which one has Bangkok?
They misjudged the
LA
demand for a return to that franchise.
I don't even think it's so much that they misjudged the demand, because the demand was definitely there, but I think what they misjudged was just how much of a public penetration it could get. You know, like I think they pushed it too.
This was the year. I think the problem too is the same kind of problem that Big Trouble in Little China had, which is people were expecting something else that they got.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Escape from L.A. is definitely much more comedy than Escape from New York is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you were looking at it came out during a summer that wasn't exactly lacking for moneymakers.
No.
Yeah.
That was the summer of Independence Day, wasn't it?
Independence Day, Mission Impossible, even Eraser made money.
Yeah.
Right?
And I mean, it's Big Trouble in Little China kind of had similar problems. Big Trouble in Little China was overshadowed by, you know, it was 86. You had Aliens, and there was the other movies that were just ripping up the box office. And I mean, Big Trouble in Little China, I think, was a late summer release. So it was kind of, you know, by that time, people were just, they were tapped out.
Was that the year of Beverly Hills Cop 2?
I think so.
Oh, that was 87.
Oh, okay. No, 86 was Big Trouble in Little China.
So I think Escape from L.A. is awesome. It's got some few flaws, but I still love it.
Oh, it has its flaws, and they are many.
Yeah. And that's why I picked it for my bad. I think it was time that somebody picked a movie that they love despite the flaws.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now for Andrew, what's your bad?
My bad is Prince of Darkness,
mm-hmm.
which is...
Good choice.
Interesting.
An often very creepy... legitimately scary movie with a very cool premise that kind of devolves into another sort of scary runaway lest you get hacked to pieces horror movie, and really doesn't fulfill the promise of its conceit, which is that essentially, you know, if you know, there's sort of matter and good, and there's antimatter and evil, and evil is sort of a physical or quantum substance that can be contained.
That was what I didn't like about it. What I didn't like about the Prince of Darkness was the MacGuffin. You know, the whole drink this crap and turn into Satan kind of thing.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, it became a MacGuffin,
mm-hmm.
and if instead of a MacGuffin, it was, you know, something
intangible.
Something that Carpenter really either he kind of, I think, maybe lost nerve and wanted to make something a bit marketable. I think with that kind of idea, you either have to like follow it as far as it's going to go or just leave it alone. And he kind of meanders between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with these sort of these very creepy moments that don't feel like they have a sort of logical connection to what's supposedly causing all of it. And you get a very, I mean, there's some really awesome stuff. I mean, there's a very cool, he uses a sort of transmission from the future
mm-hmm.
in a really interesting way. But that kind of elevates it to like a good episode of The Twilight Zone, you know, as opposed to a really, self-contained, extremely intelligent horror movie. It's kind of a little from column A, a little from column B, season to taste. And you have Prince of Darkness. Plus, for some reason, Alice Cooper is like the most prominent part of all the advertising, despite the fact that he's kind of like this non-character.
Yeah.
But he's he does kill a guy with a bike.
Yes.
And he did have a big CD come out that year.
Yes.
With a track called Prince of Darkness.
But, you know, if I get Alice Cooper in my movie, I would want him to do something more than what he does in Prince of Darkness.
Maybe talk about American Indians.
Exactly. Okay. So that's for Prince of Darkness. I mean,
I really agree. I mean, it's got a nice atmosphere for the most part, and the cast is interesting, but it just kind of flubbers.
It's got all of these sort of small bits that are really cool on their own, but they never gel into something great. Also, I really feel like the main character is the dad from Seventh Heaven, even though he's not.
Oh.
And he has a terrible mustache.
But hey, there's Donald Pleasance.
There is Donald Pleasance. There is Victor Wong in another great performance. There is Dennis Dunn again.
Yay!
So really good cast, but yeah, Carpenter didn't fulfill the potential that the movie had.
All right. I'm not sure there's much more to say about Prince of Darkness.
It's a pretty you know, unassuming movie, and I like it. I still really like Prince of Darkness. It's not a movie I dislike. You know, I as far as Carpenter flicks go, to me it was one of the last really good, you know, enjoyable Carpenter flicks. After Prince of Darkness, there were maybe only 2-3 films that I even remotely enjoyed. So, you know. I do still have a soft spot for Prince of Darkness.
And with that,
it really feels like it belongs alongside The Thing and The Fog, sort of.
It's got the same vibe for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
And within The Mouth of Madness as well.
Yeah, definitely. It almost feels like, you know, it was part of a pair with that in The Mouth of Madness. And I know like he had it, what was it he called it, his Armageddon trilogy or his Apocalypse trilogy? Yeah.
Attention.
But those two movies don't deserve to be mentioned in the same breath as The Thing.
No, God, no. No.
So with that, let's move on to generally our favorite and least favorite at the same time part of the show, the ugly or least favorite movie by said director. So I'll give John some respite and start with Steve.
You guys are going to hate me. This movie... This movie has a cult following, a huge cult following. It was something I think a lot of people didn't. I mean, I know when I was younger, nobody really knew it existed. It was one of those movies that until the late 90s or early 2000s, nobody talked about. I had seen it when it was new. I had seen it like when it first came out on home video. I hated it. I revisited it probably around 2001 or 2002. I actually tracked down a copy when it was released on DVD. I hated it. I am talking about the Rowdy Roddy Piper, Keith David shitfest, They Live. The movie is heavy-handed, horribly, like, trying to make the most obviously stupid and idiotic political statement. The action is, for once, terrible. Everything feels like it was made on a budget of $10. Roddy Piper's a shitty fucking actor. The scene where he beats up Keith David in the alley is goddamn stupid. The entire movie serves no freaking purpose. Roll credits, the end, move on. John Carpenter's one overly steaming pile of shit, in my opinion. And that's all I got to say about it. Defend. Go ahead. Defend it if you dare.
Well, I'm not really going to defend it that much because it's a movie
Start eating that trash can. Just be warned that the trash can is full of poop.
The movie is crap. The movie is garbage. The movie has no redeeming qualities whatsoever, other than one or two one-liners that were used in Duke Nukem.
Didn't you say you were done?
No, well, I heard you seemed like you were getting ready to do something, so I thought I'd tear it down a little bit more first.
I actually don't think very much of it at all.
I hate it.
But and I totally agree that, you know, it is an incredibly ham-fisted attempt at, like, political filmmaking and, like, oh, materialism bad.
Obey.
And you can't even, you know, you can't even enjoy it on the same level as something like Hell Comes to Frogtown, which was so ridiculously insane, you know? Like, it wasn't an insane movie. It was just stupid. Roddy just kind of walked.
I kind of love Roddy Piper in the movie, but that's not to say that he's a good actor.
He is. I found the guy had no presence. I found he just kind of roamed around wearing a jean jacket. It's like they followed him around. MacArthur Park with a camera.
What they should have done was given him the set of Piper's Pit and a shit ton of cocaine.
Hey, Roddy Piper just got fired off WWE and he's a deadbeat living in MacArthur Park. Let's move him around with a camera and turn it into a movie.
Yep.
I mean, when you think
about
it, I keep
telling you to get that lens out of my face.
It is a pretty cruddy movie, and I think the only way to enjoy it is ironically, and that's never a good thing.
I don't know. I there's something about the look of the movie, that sort of like 50s sci-fi paranoia style, that when he puts on the glasses, and I'm not going to say it's a good movie, but for some reason that I don't even think I can articulate, I enjoy it.
But, you enjoy it because people tell you you should enjoy it. That's why you enjoy it.
Don't give me that.
It's because you've seen the big posters of They Live and it's actually said enjoy when you put on the glasses.
No, I mean, it builds to this like total anticlimax.
There is no final act.
No.
There's
no act at all. Like, it's just kind of formless.
There's one set piece in the movie, and it's Roddy Piper and Keith David beating each other up in an alley.
I like when he shoots people in the
back. Which sounds kind of dirty.
Yeah. And it's not even particularly well filmed. It's just the two of them beating each other up.
Yeah, they just kind of, like, stick a camera there.
Yeah.
But I think John wanted to say something.
Sorry, John.
Yeah, this is something I've wanted to get off my chest for a long time. I don't get the appeal of Meg Foster. She's a horrible, horrible actress.
Oh, yes.
Masters of the Universe was awesome.
Yeah, Masters of the Universe was awesome because of...
Frank Langella, the Skeletor.
Yeah, Frank Langella.
Oh, she's creepy looking now. I mean, not that she wasn't before, but... like, especially so now.
Before it was the fact that, you know, it looks like she has cat eyes implanted in her head, but now she's all wrinkly and.
So, John, what's your ugly?
You guys all got good choices for your ugly, and I don't want to double up on anyone, so I'm just gonna. I'm gonna go the Troit path. Let's see. I got to flip a coin on this because they both are kind of meandering. But I don't have a coin.
flip that USB drive you've been clicking all evening.
What?
Flip that USB drive you've been clicking on all evening.
I've been clicking on a USB drive.
No? Okay.
That was probably my mouse.
Oh, never mind.
So I was switching between...
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I don't even want to participate anymore.
You used to do it all the time.
What do you want to make fun of more? My spring-loaded USB drive.
Yeah. We'd be recording blast processing, and all you hear all night is click, 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 click.
Kind of like this?
Yes. Yeah, a lot like that. Anyway, sorry, John. You were saying?
What do you guys want to make fun of more? I'll let you pick. Ghosts of Mars or vampires?
Vampires.
Yeah, Ghost of Mars has redeemable qualities.
It does. People don't want to admit it.
It does.
Yeah.
Doesn't really.
and I haven't seen Ghost of Mars, so.
Vampires. I thought you were watching it earlier.
I wasn't in the mood.
Mood is the thing for cattle and love play.
I just got that. Oh, here's something hilarious before we move on to that. I just ran an image search for Meg Foster. And one of the first pictures that came up is one of the bad guys they created for Masters of the Universe, the one that had the hook for the hand and the really bad fright wig and the wrinkly face.
Hook?
And that's hilarious.
Anyway. Vampires.
Vampires.
That's going to be my Facebook photo.
Well, yeah, vampires. when you want badass, as in like physically imposing, you get James Woods.
I'll be honest, I thought he was the only redeeming quality of that movie.
Well, he was. I love James Woods, and he was awful in this.
People told me about it. Man, it's so badass. they fire a grappling hook into the vampires and drag them out into the sun.
Nothing happens. Man, it was just like the opening scene of the movie and the final act were exactly the same.
Yeah.
It was like they just basically doubled up on footage.
And Daniel Baldwin, this is like, this is the point where they kicked him out of the family and adopted Adam.
And who plays the girl again?
They were trying to get a Baldwin, and they just had to keep going down one.
Who plays the girl again? Is it like Cheryl
Lee? Lee?
Oh, she's awful.
She is.
Yeah. Oh, everything about this movie is so, like, just over the top, like.
Total waste of Maximilian Schell.
Yeah.
Yep.
As the cardinal who turns evil for no reason.
Yep. Just
because he's part of the church.
Yeah.
you know it's bad when I'd actually want to watch Near Dark instead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey.
Here's the thing. Here's the other thing. Okay. Like, James Woods has this like speech about how vampires, they're not all romantic. They're not a bunch of like Euro trash. Blah blah blah. And then that's exactly the vampire we're giving.
Yeah, yeah, he's got right down to the white frilly shirt.
Yeah, because listen, that's one of the, pardon the cheesiness of this cliche. One of the nails in the coffin for me for a shitty vampire movie is when they bring up that whole self-aware. It's not like in the movies.
Yeah, right.
That's probably the reason I love Fright Night so much.
They should have advertised it as this is a vampire movie with bite.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Oh, vampires. So much mediocrity.
Yeah, and I remember Vampires was like, you know, right around the time of the real, like the boom of the internet movie sites, you know, Any Cool News, Dark Horizons, Joe Blow, all of these guys. And everybody was talking about Vampires like this big mythical film, you know, and it's like, man, John Carpenter made a new horror movie and no studio wants to release it. Oh my God, what's wrong with them? You know?
And then they actually saw the movie and they're like, oh.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, okay. My bad.
I do remember there being like a weird amount of hype for it.
Yeah.
Because it was one of those movies that had been finished and sitting on a shelf and no one would release it. No one would pick up the crates, right?
And also, like, it's vampires and it's a Western. How cool is that?
Except it's not. It fails as a Western.
And the original title was supposed to be Vampires, but the S was a dollar sign.
Based on a terrible book by John Stakely.
Well, I love the fact that John, it's based Stakely? On a novel.
No, he spells it steak like meat.
Oh, okay.
Still
but yeah, the book was horrible. The book was absolutely horrible.
The movie was no better. And
the movie does have Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa in it, though.
Well, that's always good.
Always love.
Does he take anyone's soul?
No, unfortunately.
Mortal Kombat!
Oh, vampires. There were sequels to that, too.
Oh.
Yeah,
I was working in a video store when
wasn't there?
When Vampires Los Muertos came out
with the
awesome tagline "Wanted undead or alive."
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
but wasn't there kind of a vampire revival at that time as well?
Yeah.
Well, From Dusk Till Dawn came out in '96. Yeah. But I can't imagine that after From Dusk Till Dawn, anyone would make a movie as like trite as vampires.
We're not going to mention my feelings on From Dusk Till Dawn.
But what was the Natasha Gregson Warner one? Jeez. Never mind. It's a shitty vampire flick. So, Andrew, what's your ugly?
My ugly? Well, for me, there really was no choice, but the movie that drove Christopher Reeve into jumping off a horse with no helmet. And that is Village of the Damned.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Cold as ice. Totally cold as ice.
I gotta say, Andrew, that was pretty tasteless. And I don't want to look forward to you anymore.
That's just how I figure it happened.
But now he did have a helmet on, didn't he? But it was one of those crappy little, like, velvet-covered riding helmets.
It was a desperate cry for help.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What would you do if you just starred in a movie that even Kirstie Alley was ashamed of?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And one of the last movies that Mark Hamill actually starred in.
He was terrible in.
He looked like he was 70 in this movie.
Village of the Damned was all around a pretty awful movie.
Village of the Damned was Michael Paré's last stop.
Yeah.
In theaters.
And it's sad. I loved Michael Paré.
I don't even know where to begin with this movie. I mean, first of all, it takes, you know, it's, the original is not incredibly directed or anything, but it is legitimately a classic. I mean, it's certainly influenced a huge number of horror movies that came after it, and was genuinely creepy. But this is not creepy at all. It's
dull. Very dull.
And the kids look ridiculous.
Those wigs, man.
The wigs are the worst things I've ever seen.
It almost feels like a Children of the Corn sequel.
Yeah. It really kind of does.
And it's not one of the good ones. Sort of went together in my mind.
Are there good ones?
No, there weren't really.
It's one of those, like, it feels like Children of the Corn. It feels like a cheap, you know, somebody got the rights to a Stephen King novel, and they know someone who owns a farm, and they film everything in daylight because they can't afford nightlights. You know, Carpenter manages like a bit of like visual flair toward the end with, you know, the showdown between Christopher Reeve and the kids.
I remember there being really, really bad optical effects in this too.
You know, that's actually one of the things that doesn't seem as bad in retrospect.
Okay.
Just because everything else is so awful.
Now, see, I haven't seen it since the theatrical.
The effects aren't great, but they're kind of better than the practical effects, which look like they, you know, like they're like these little alien fetuses and various things that look like, you know, they just went shopping just after Halloween at a costume shop that was having a discount sale. And dull is really the thing that most defines this movie. It is a slog. And it's only like, it's not even that long. It's only an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But it feels like it just goes on and on and on.
Like they live.
How did this movie cost $2 million? I don't.
Yeah, it's not a good film.
No.
And so, for my ugly, I picked the movie that ended John Carpenter's chance at the big budget pictures, and that is Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
I think I just threw up on my soul a little.
Yep.
That was a terrible, terrible movie.
The only thing that it's got going for it are the special effects and Sam Neill.
Yeah,
and that's about it.
Yep. Hey, that's two more things in Village of the Damned I'd go for.
And, you know, I kind of remembered it not being that bad, but I saw it like a few months ago, and I'm like, oh, man.
Yeah.
What was I high on when I thought this was good? I don't really mind Chevy Chase that much in the movie, but it's just the whole movie that is such a mess and not interesting in any way. There's so many places it could have gone, and you compare it with the Verhoeven Invisible Man movie.
Hollow Man, yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, that's so much better, and that's in no way a really good flick.
I like to think that Verhoeven saw Memoirs of an Invisible Man and said, you know what was missing from this movie? Rape.
That's always what's missing, John, isn't it?
And Kevin Bacon dong.
Yeah.
I mercifully pushed that out of my mind.
What else is there to say about Memoirs of an Invisible Man? It's bad. It's truly, truly, truly the bottom of the barrel.
It was his first major studio film since Big Trouble in Little China, and I think apparently he was brought in after the original director had a tiff with Chevy Chase and quit or something.
Which Charlie never has problems with his directors.
Yeah, and then I believe the whole reason that it doesn't say John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man is because Chevy Chase wouldn't allow it.
Hmm.
But he seems like such a nice guy.
Medium.
Ivan Reitman was the original director.
Oh, that would have been something else.
Yeah, Ivan Reitman.
It would have been something else.
Are you saying Ivan Reitman has made bad films, Andrew?
Like, he's naturally likable in most of his roles, but he was so wrong for this.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's just, not a good film.
At least Daryl Hannah looks good.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's Daryl Hannah. She always looks good.
That's another thing, guys, I just don't get. Okay, so you take a comedian who's, you know, does these great facial double takes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put him in a role where you don't see him.
Yep.
At all.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
Right?
For me, Chevy Chase has only done maybe 3 good movies anyway, so, you know.
Again, medium talent.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's just the sickest burn ever.
But enough of the bad stuff. Let's get together and give our good thoughts on John Carpenter. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I mean, obviously, we've talked about this. He has a distinctive and very well-assured visual style. And most of his movies look amazing. There's some rough ones, but for the most part, like visually at least, his movies look amazing and he gets the job done. I just generally like the vibe that he puts into his movies. I like the atmosphere, and his horror movies for me are the ones that work the best. Although I love Big Trouble in Little China, obviously. But he has this sort of distinctive flavor, sort of a nice edge of cynicism to go along with the horror, and a sense of humor too, which is, you know, it's rare to have a director who's really good at horror and also can get a few laughs without totally evaporating all the tension. So.
Without breaking the movie that he's working on, you know, without
the thing actually has a number of really funny moments.
It does. It really does. Prime example is John earlier with the whole, you know, if it's all the same to you fellas. That's a prime example.
You know, anytime Windows opens his mouth.
I was sad when the 90s stood on their balcony and threw all of John Carpenter's clothes onto the ground and told him to leave forever.
The 90s did that to a lot of
the late 90s. It was the late 90s, not the early 90s.
Yeah, well, he kind of struggled right through there. His movies weren't really making money.
Well, one good point for the late 90s, Escape from L.A.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think also does show, I think he lost the sense of what audiences wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, I think you can say that. I don't think John Carpenter really understands who's going to the movies and what people want to see these days, and certainly in the 90s as well.
Yeah, I mean, the word is very old-fashioned.
Yeah. But, you know, I hope he appears to be immortal, so I hope he has at least one more in him.
You can't kill Imhotep.
No.
Basically, Carpenter is Lopan by now.
Yeah.
which Lopan? This little old basket case on wheels or the 7-foot-tall roadblock?
Both. So who wants to go next?
I'll chime in. When I look back, like when we started thinking about the filmography and stuff, when we started thinking about doing them for an episode, I went back and started, you know, rewatching. And I mean, it's really hard for me to sit down and watch Big Trouble in Little China. I can never really do it. I have to be in a particular mood, which is total bullshit. I could watch it right now in a heartbeat and then turn it on again in 3 hours' time and watch it again.
Thanks. You knew most of the words, but they weren't making sense.
No, it's one of those movies that I could visit, like, indeterminate. It's a desert island disc, you know? Like, I could watch it over and over and over again until the end of time. It's that kind of movie for me. But when I went back through his filmography, I found a lot more stuff that I was either lukewarm on or just outright didn't like. And you know what? The majority of his stuff, I have no taste for. I mean, I appreciate that he's a brilliant technical director. I like how he shoots action. It's not always perfect, but I like it. Big Trouble in Little China is one of my absolute favorite films of all time. But I think what success he did have, I mean, he had Halloween, which was original and hit huge. Because, I mean, he admitted himself it was inspired by Suspiria and certain other, you know, early 70s horror films. But, you know, he brought it to an audience that hadn't seen that kind of horror, and it just clicked. But I really think, you know, every bit of acclaim that the guy has gotten has been purely by fluke. I mean, you say, you know, he's lost touch with what audiences want to see. I don't think he ever really knew.
Well, yeah, I think that's actually probably fair.
Yeah, I think he always kind of went his own way, and he clicked. And, I mean, he's had some amazing, amazing films. I mean, some of the classics, the modern classics. I mean, you know, The Thing, Escape from New York, I mean, is about as fantastic as B-movies get. Assault on Precinct 13, again, great little just tight B-action movie, you know, like exploitation.
Aside from having a tough guy named Napoleon Wilson.
Yeah, well, okay, fair enough. But, but you know, like he has the chops. He has the means. But I think sometimes his own sensibilities kind of get in the way of cranking out a really effective film. And I think that once... I think once the 90s hit, when the studios kind of turned on him as such, when funding kind of said, you know, maybe not John, you know, that kind of thing. People started kind of saying no to him. And on top of that, in the 80s, he had this stable of great, you know, indie actors to draw from. He had guys like Sam Neill, Kurt Russell, and all of these guys. But in the 90s, when everybody started kind of gravitating to these big tentpole, you know, major studio movies, he couldn't get the same talent, which is why you end up with guys like Ice Cube playing Desolation Williams in Ghost of Mars. You know, if that had been a Kurt Russell role, that movie would have been fucking incredible. You know?
And it's all no-names in the ward.
Yeah, except for, well, Amber Heard, who people know now, but people didn't know her then. You know?
And also, I think one thing worth mentioning is, I think, you know, John Carpenter sees himself very much as an iconoclast. And sometimes, especially like with They Live, for example, you know, he tries just a little too hard to be like the guy who's just too cool for school. And it comes off being not cool.
And I think the last real thought for me, the master of terror or the master of horror, John, stop cashing in on Halloween. Halloween was a long time ago, man.
Right, you did The Thing.
You have not been the master of anything since 1982. You know, it's been a long freaking time since you made a really effective movie, man. You know, like, I mean, as much as I might love Escape from L.A., or even, like, you know, In the Mouth of Madness, I think is a great flick. Prince of Darkness is a great flick. Even The Ward and Ghosts of Mars have their redeeming qualities, but everything he's done since, you know, 1989 has been
not the work of a master,
and
no,
horribly compromised, if not on a technical end, then on a studio end, you know, like that, just not having talent to sell what he's trying to make.
And that's the sad thing too. Remember when we were talking about, like, Peckinpah, it just crashed and burned because of all his demons, while Carpenter just seems to have lost it.
Yeah, Carpenter, and it's not even, I can't even say that he lost it. I think it's that he just, what the fans and what certain people seem to think that he had, he never really had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, I mean, that's not to slight Carpenter. Like I said, I love a lot of Carpenter's movies, but there's the majority of stuff out there that he's done, I'm just kind of, I'm lukewarm on. You know, I'm lukewarm or outright hostile towards.
John, any more to add to that?
Not really. Just go rent The Thing if you haven't seen it yet.
And you know what? The prequel/remake was actually pretty damn good too.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was quite enjoyable.
One thing we have to give to Carpenter too is writing some very distinctive themes for his movies. As simplistic as they get, they're often very memorable.
Yep.
Yeah, He was a synth king.
That being said, the Coup de Villes in Big Trouble Little China was terrible.
Yes, Big Trouble Absolutely. China had one flaw.
So,
Dad's getting up on stage. Everybody look away.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I think it was Gary Oldman who said when you come out of the movies, you should feel like you had a rocket strapped to your ass. Well, that's how you feel coming out of Big Trouble in Little China, and then the end credits start, and the rocket just veers off into a brick wall.
the rocket goes Challenger.
So I think that pretty much wraps up our view of John Carpenter, someone with a very distinctive style and great eye for shot composition who might not have all the talent that people thought he had. Stay tuned for next week when we'll be discussing Michael Mann.
Oh.
Should be an entertaining time.
A man's man.
So, <Hey. laughs>
So until next week, sit tight, keep the home fires burning, and if we're not back by dawn,
call the president.
President of what?